M15, number 3A.
Well, I just quickly recapitulate the tone of principle as mind, spirit, and soul. What we see at the point of the 4,000-year period, the question of government enters into discussion. Who shall rule? Who shall govern? What shall govern? So at the point of principle as mind, Samuel presented that actually ideas should govern, ideas of principle, therefore the vision of principle should govern, and Samuel was an illustration, an exponent of that, because he always would ask the Lord what to do. So he ruled through metaphysics as a theocratic government. That was rejected by the people, and instead of that they got Saul, who didn't have the first faint idea about God, no spiritual vision, no spiritual qualities. So we come to principle as spirit, where it shows that principle must govern through spiritual qualities, like shown in David. He was bringing forth all those spiritual qualities which would unite everybody into one government. He would never accept an enemy. Saul was not his enemy. He could have killed him many times, but he never did it. He said, I'm not going to touch Saul because he also is the beloved of God, and I'm not going to put my hands on him. You say that? No, you don't say that way. Yeah? Okay, wonderful. Main thing is, you know what I mean. So he could, through his qualities of womanhood, David had a lot of womanhood quality, and he was taught by women in his life to put on this womanhood quality, that he would always try to embrace everyone and not hurt the oil and the wine. Not hurt anybody. That brought then the kingdom of David about, and Solomon, and with Solomon already, you know, again that spiritual value somehow got into the background, and the gold and the silver and the splendor of Solomon came into the forefront, and so after Solomon the kingdom fell into two parts and never was united again. In its place came the opposite of Saul to govern, namely sin, the breaking of the law. They were no more obeying the law nor the prophets. The prophets were persecuted. Religion was materialized in the temple and in outward worship, and therefore had within itself the seed of self-destruction. So at the point of principle as soul, the first prophet rose up and said, the solution will only come about if Israel has to go into captivity and be deprived of all the false outward worship. And you can see how beloved those prophets were when they said, like Jeremiah, you will have to go down into captivity. So they persecuted him naturally. But all those early prophets like Amos, like Hosea, Jeremiah, they all could see that Israel had to be freed from the narrowness of a materialistic ritual religion, and could only free itself, you hear the freedom of soul, if they would go beyond the limits of any limitation in their religion. And that limit was always be considered Euphrates, over there was Babylon, over there was Assyria, so they had to go beyond Euphrates. And that is what then actually happened. They came into Babylonian captivity. the counterfeit of principle as soul. Then came that wonderful period of principle as principle, where they could sit around the teaching, around the documents, around the primitive documents, the heroistic documents, the Deuteronomy documents, could discuss it, and finally the prophetic school over there brought about a new edition, the priestly document. And so the religion became a book religion. And the priestly document showed forth in a systematic way what the religion of principle is. In that period, we have Ezekiel. I like Ezekiel very much because he is the one who presents his whole prophecy in an exact terminology, in systematic build-up. He actually may have been the one who was writing the Days of Creation, because he is the only one at that time who began to deliver his prophecy in the layout of the 7 days of creation. He had the same layout as the Days of Creation, 3, 3, 5, 5, 4, 7, 2. And he not only gave that simple structure of the prophecy, because he could see that there are many more categories intertwined in it. Just as we have been considering yesterday or the day before how the Days of Creation would contain also the standpoint of absolute Christian Science in its impact on the level of Christian Science. We could also see that the 7 days of creation had within themselves the Word as Christ, Word as Christianity, Word as Science, a new category. We could also see that the whole diagonal of the matrix was somehow interwoven into that structure. And so Ezekiel was saying right from the beginning that he could see a wheel and wheels within wheels. He began to see that there are many categories interwoven in the one being, that there is not just a straight line of order from beginning to end, but that actually those seven were a circle, a wheel, and that wheel was not just a wheel, but that there were wheels within the wheels. And gave with that symbolism, think of it, he had no other way of symbolizing such a thing at that time, but through that terrific symbolism, that everything is turning round within it, within one another, and gives a terrific picture of the wheels within wheels. Categories within categories, we would say today. So don't be afraid if we see the textbook in categories and categories within categories. That great whale called Ezekiel has seen that long ago. And he wasn't afraid to write it down as a prophecy for the Jewish people. Yes. So here we get the systematization of of Jewish religion, and then when that was established, it had such an impact on the people and on the new conqueror of Babylon, the Persian Darius, King Darius, whatever it is, that he let the people go home. Not only did he let go home, but he also supported them to build the temple again, to build that symbol of the principle of the Jewish religion, again. And you know then, that's the newness of life, you know, now you have the paradigm shift. Now they go back and they begin again from a new basis, from the basis of the priestly document, from a new basis of teaching, and they begin to rebuild the temple. And if you read Haggai, we see that they are rebuilding the temple in greater splendor than before. That naturally, with every mutation of in our understanding, we can really see the system of principle in a more complex way than before. And so he asked the people not to build first their sealed houses, but that they all should first pull together and build the temple. Wow, if we would do that, huh? If we would have that sense that we take Christian Science not in the first place to build our sealed houses. Is that the right term, sealed houses? You know, make our little houses, our private house, our private business, our private surroundings, our ego beautiful with nice sealed bricks and so on. But that we all see first that we should build the temple of God. That we should all pull together in the first place for a collective, for a generic endeavor, namely to build up in a new age like today the science of Christian Science, and are not so much concerned about our personal little problems that anyway don't matter. They will not change the world. They will have no impact on the world. You can be quite sure. You can have your thousands and thousands little problems and big problems. They don't matter. They actually don't matter. Nobody's interested in them. They are not going to revolutionize the world. And that was Haggai could see. That he could see it's all wrong if we take the science of that principle and apply it just for our own personal use. That it should be there in order to build the one temple. The structure of the science of Christian Science. So we get there the new beginning, the principle as life, you see, that principle having undergone a paradigm shift, that we can bring forth a higher sense, a newer sense, and Mr. Zeddy had explained it in that tone in the days of creation, principle as life, that divine science must be its interpreter, so that we have new periods of progress. And that finally led to the real idea of kingship and government. It led to the real king, Jesus, the king of the Jews. And that ended that 4,000-year period. Yeah. Isn't it a terrific story, the Bible? And it all applies to our own consciousness. So we come to the 5,000-year period, starting with Jesus. And here we must first see something fundamental in order to explain that 5,000-year period. At a 1,000-year period, we would have to see that it covers the time from Jesus' birth up to around about 1,000 A.D., that whole period of 1,000 years. But if you think back, what we have seen also as the day of life, in the days of creation, that Mrs. Eddy says that the numerals of infinity called 7 days can never be reckoned according to the calendar of time. And then she goes on and explains that it will bring newness of life, and thought will accept the divine infinite calculus. We have seen, therefore, that we, at the point of life, of isness, we could also consider the fifth day not as a day that is leading to the sixth day and to the seventh day, but from a higher standpoint to see that they present the isness of being, the numerals of infinity. Now, this is the way that Jesus looked at the fifth day of creation. He looked at it from the standpoint of the numerals of infinity, namely from that standpoint where he didn't acknowledge that there was a past, nor that there is a future of another 3,000 years until he could demonstrate the One, the Infinite One. He knew that everything was at the point of isness, and therefore that he could fulfill the days of creation right now as a sense of isness, and therefore he would not accept any time sense. You remember how he would say, ye say that it takes another 4 months until the harvest, 4 months, that it takes again the word as the word, and the word as the Christ, and the word as Christianity, and the word as science to the harvest, having a time sense in it. He said, ye say, there are still 4 months to the harvest, but he said, lo and behold, the harvest is here. Everything is right now, ripe to be harvested. Can you say harvested? Even that you can say. Good. So, he approached the 7,000-year period not as days of creation, not in a time sense, but he said, now is the accepted time. Yes? Now is the day of salvation. So he himself refuted this millennium theory. He refuted it. He didn't accept it. He said, for me, individually, I don't need to go through those 1,000-year periods. If I go out from isness, then there are numerals of infinity, and I'm going jolly well to demonstrate that they are right now, and that I can make the full demonstration of life, truth, and love right now. And he did it. So, in that way, we can really see that he didn't have to go and wait another 1,000 years in order to bring about the highest sense of life, and then wait another 1,000 years for the demonstration of truth that he finally, in the 7,000 years, would make the grade. He therefore accepted it as right now, I'm not come to destroy it, but to fulfill the law. I'm going to show you right now that I'm come that ye may have life, and that ye may have life abundant, and he proved it. So, we can see life in its four subtones, actually in the short span of his own life, of his few years of his earthly mission. On the other side, if we say, but the whole thing is not just a matter, it's not that something that concerns Jesus, it's something that concerns all humanity, and we know that the whole of humanity is not willing to accept right now, even at that time, the fullness of being. So for humanity, naturally, the 1,000-year periods developed in the same rhythm onward. So, those four subtones of life, to recapitulate it, in Jesus' life can be seen within his short span of life. But we can also see those four subtones as a 1,000-year period, and therefore see the fifth day of creation running through the subtones within the 1,000 years. So we have to distinguish that. And so I first take how Jesus fulfilled life as the fullness of life by taking in all four subtones. How did he demonstrate the isness of life? First, through life as mind. Through life as mind. What did we see in life as mind in the days of creation? Can you think right back? Life as mind was saying, let the waters bring forth abundantly, and the fowls that fly above the earth, that they soar into the open firmament of heaven. And we have seen the fifth day begins, therefore, with soaring above the mortal, above the earthbound, which means that we have to lay down the mortal, earthly sense of life. And that is what he was proving constantly at the point of life as mind, that Jesus was laying down, really, the mortal sense of life, and so fulfilled, really, the numeral of infinity at that point. He always would show what is it that enables us to lay down a false sense of life. And he always said, that's love. Love is a small L. And he said, herein is love that a man lays down his life for another's good, that he is willing to really to give up a mortal sense of life, an egotistic sense of life, a sense that we have our own life, that we live our own life. All that has to be given up for what? Just for the idea of life. Then he showed, after he has done that, the tone of life as spirit. What is life as spirit in the days of creation? It showed there the true individuality of man. It showed that every man can reflect the whole of God in his individual way. And therefore, because there is the whole of God, that reflection can be a terrific big reflection. It can be a whale, and Jesus was one of those whales. That he accepted and acknowledged for himself all the qualities of God. So he became a life exemplar for everyone, because he demonstrated now life individually, the whole of life individually, and brought out a sense of exaltation. He was really living above the mortal sense of life. You see, he had the true sense of life because he took hold of the infinite life. He wasn't waiting until somebody allowed it to take hold of it. He said, ye have not chosen me, I have chosen you. He always chose for himself. He always chose the way to go, the way he understood it, and not the way something was prescribed for him, what he had to do, and why he had to do, and when he had to do. He was that free man, an absolute free individuality, with no restriction of any sort and kind, that would always go right to the Father and say, the Father supplies me with all I need. He supplies me with vision, he supplies me with substance, he supplies me with all I need for every situation. So he could actually be an exemplar for any situation. He really expressed that infinite individuality. He could be a teacher, he could be a healer, he could be an expounder of the law, therefore a lawyer. He was managing his finances very well. He was telling what is true sociology. He was telling something about true government. He was aware of that he could give a new sense of physics, where gravitation was not a law, where the spiritual gravitation was the only law. He would be able to overcome time and space. He was a new type of a physicist, the prototype of a physicist, of that physicist which may come next 1,000-year period. So he was the physicist as a metaphysicist, and showed again his terrific individuality. There was no field of life and experience where he was not the master. And every time he showed forth a new individuality. So he didn't need a temple. He said, well, I am the temple of God. A living God is the temple of God. And therefore he did away with the concept of temple that was so central to the Jewish religion, right from Moses with the tabernacle up to the building of the temple in Jerusalem and afterwards of the rebuilding of the temple. And he could see that he could really exalt that sense of a temple to be the temple himself. He was really shown that wonderful individuality in every way.